From the WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet Joseph Salerno. He was a key witness in the trial that brought down the Philadelphia and South Jersey mob. For 10 years, he's lived under an assumed name given him by the Federal Witness Protection Program. The mob has a $200,000 murder contract on his life. Also today, Babar the Elephant, the creator of the popular children's books, died in 1937. Since the 1940s, Babar has been written and drawn by the creator's son, Laurent de Brunhoff. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews the first CD devoted to the Spanish singer Conchita Supervilla. And we have a reading from poet Mark Halliday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. An earthquake hit Los Angeles today, shaking 40-story buildings and bouncing cars and trucks on freeways interlacing the cities. Little immediate damage was reported, apart from goods falling off supermarket shelves. The Soviet Parliament today passed a land reform law that gives peasants the right to leave collective farms and set up their own homesteads. The new law is part of President Mikhail Gorbachev's plan to jolt Soviet agriculture into becoming more productive. The move strikes at one of the basic principles of Soviet socialism, which says that all means of production, such as land and capital, should be collectively owned. Following his election defeat on Sunday, President Daniel Ortega of Nicaragua has declared a unilateral ceasefire in the war against the U.S.-backed Contras. This report from Alan Tomlinson in Nicaragua.
A government communique said that by holding free elections, Nicaragua had now complied fully with the terms of a regional peace agreement signed by all five Central American presidents. It was now the turn of the Contras to lay down their arms and of the United States to cut off funding to the rebels, except for their swift demobilization. Ortega also called on Honduras to begin dismantling the Contra base camps in its territory in compliance with the peace accord. The communique said Nicaragua's Sandinista People's Army would cease fire unilaterally to facilitate the process. The government now expects an estimated 2,000 Contras operating inside Nicaragua to surrender to United Nations peacekeeping forces in the country and for several thousand more rebels in Honduras to begin a repatriation process. In Managua, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
Back from Nicaragua, where he monitored the national elections, former President Jimmy Carter reported today to Secretary of State James Baker on the coming transition to a pro-U.S. government. The biggest obstacle, Carter said, is a U.S. armed Contra army. Barry Schwide has more.
Carter said Humberto Ortega, the Sandinista Minister of Defense, is ready to yield control over the Nicaraguan armed forces to the winning opposition. And Carter said winners and losers want a smooth transition of power. But Carter said the Contras are a destabilizing force. He said any time an independent army is within the borders of a country or just outside it, that army causes disruption. Carter said the guerrillas who fought against the Sandinistas should be able to come home if they wish and live peacefully in Nicaragua. But he said they must give up their weapons and disband. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Senators and Bush administration officials have reached a tentative compromise on auto emission limits, a key roadblock to congressional action on clean air legislation, that from an aide to Senate Democratic leader George Mitchell. Prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed more than 10 points. Advances led declines 9 to 5. This is NPR News. More than 60 people have died in Europe as violent storms continue for the third straight day. Workers are trying to contain the damage as high winds and waves pound the Atlantic and North Sea coasts. Areas in the Alps have been ripped by winds clocked at 145 miles an hour, and some villages are reported cut off by heavy snows. Most of the deaths so far have been caused by flying debris. More problems for the already troubled basketball program at North Carolina State University. Two criminal investigations are underway involving former members of the team. Adam Hochberg reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
North Carolina State already is on NCAA probation for incidents in which players improperly sold their complimentary game tickets. Now law enforcement officers in North Carolina and New Jersey reportedly are investigating point shaving. Former NC State player Charles Shackelford has admitted improperly accepting money from a New Jersey businessman while he was on the team, and investigators are trying to determine whether gambling was involved. Authorities also reportedly are investigating two other former players, Benny Bolton and Tevin Binns. Bolton denies he's done anything wrong.
I guess it's just the nature of investigating a team that with many players. I mean, I guess each one of them can be pointed at and be accused of being guilty of something, and I guess I'm not immune to that.
Coach Jim Valvano denies he had any knowledge of wrongdoing on the team. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
NASA officials confirmed today that the space shuttle Atlantis has been launched into an orbit that will allow it to pass over most of the major cities and industrial areas of the Soviet Union. The shuttle is on a secret military mission that's said to include releasing a highly sophisticated new military spy satellite. In order to reach its orbit, NASA officials said the shuttle was launched on a course that took it closer than ever to the East Coast. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1988, the reigning crime family of Philadelphia and South Jersey was destroyed in a federal racketeering trial. Crime boss Nicky Scarfo and 15 of his associates were convicted and given sentences ranging from 30 to 55 years. My guest, Joseph Salerno, is one of the witnesses whose testimony helped put them away. Salerno was a plumber working in Atlantic City when he got involved with Scarfo, whose organization had penetrated the construction industry in South Jersey. Salerno was the first witness to directly place Scarfo at the scene of a murder. Salerno recounted how in 1979 he was with Scarfo and two of his associates when they executed a contractor because he had previously insulted Scarfo. After the hit, Salerno joined the Federal Witness Protection Program and testified in several cases against Scarfo. The mob put a $200,000 price on Salerno's head after he first testified in 1980. Joseph Salerno has a new book about testifying against the mob and living in the Witness Protection Program. It's called The Plumber, and it's co-authored by Stephen Revell. Salerno is very critical of the Witness Protection Program.
They never did anything for me. All they did for me was just change my name, Social Security number, along with my family, my wife and my three children. And that's basically it. They just leave you, and you bear with it. You have no identification. You have no background. And you have to take a lot of chances and trust people, like if you want to go and get a job. Where'd you work before? Okay, fill out this application. How do you verify your references or employment? They don't help you with anything like that. They just don't do it.
What about the protection part of the Witness Protection Program?
The protection part of it is that basically they change your name and your Social Security number and you're on your own. If you want to come back to the danger area, you know, that's up to you. You know, if you want to stay put wherever you are and be safe, you know, that's up to you too.
You're in what's called the danger area now because
yes.
This interview is being recorded.
Mm-hmm.
In Philadelphia. You're from New Jersey, and it was the Scarfo family, which is the big crime family from the South Jersey, Philadelphia area that
mm-hmm.
That you testified against. What kind of special precautions do you have to take when you come back here?
The only special precautions I have to take is if I'm with a law enforcement official, like the people I'm with today, Atlantic County Prosecutor's Office and the FBI, okay? That's it, and I'm fine. I'm very comfortable with that. Because these people will not dare come near, you know, any law enforcement people. They just won't.
Do you think there's still the $200,000 contract out on you?
Let me put it this way. It's never been canceled, okay? And that's the answer to it. I don't know if it is or if it isn't, but it's never been canceled.
With all the leaders of the crime family behind bars, would there still be people to carry out the contract?
Well, I don't think that anyone would do anything for Nicky Scarfo that's on the outside, but if there's someone who wanted to make a name for themselves, let's say, that I know where Joe Salerno is, I could pinpoint him and, you know, I want to go after him, I want to hurt him, you know? That's what I had to be careful about.
Let's talk about how you got involved with the organized crime in the Philadelphia, South Jersey area. You were working as a plumber. You had your own business. How did you start making connections with organized crime?
Okay. I was a plumber in Brigantine, New Jersey. I had my own business. In the early 70s, I worked for different contractors, and I worked along with Scarf Incorporated, which was owned by Nicky Scarfo and his nephew, Philip Leonetti. And I worked side by side with these people for several years, five, six, 7 years or whatever. Then it got to be late 70s that I got into financial difficulty. I got a loan from these people. At the time, I did not know where the money came from. Okay, I got it from Philip Leonetti. He wouldn't tell me where it came from at that time. I borrowed $10,000. I paid $250 a week for 13 months, just interest, before the principal part of the loan. I occupied an apartment on Georgia Avenue in Atlantic City, which was owned by Scarfo, Nicky Scarfo, and they also ran Scarf Incorporated out of that same location. And what started to happen was I started to go out with these people, dinners, whatever. I got very familiar with Scarfo, and he told me some of his deep, dark secrets. Told me that he murdered someone. How he did it, he described it to me. You know, he did it with a knife. He twisted it. Now the guy's dead. Anything we say between me and you, we keep it quiet. Or he'd make a gesture with his hand, gun. Then he'd point to his mouth, keep your mouth shut. Or, you know, we do it here, pointing to his forehead and his chest. This is first thing. Second thing is you go to, I approached Philip one day, and I asked Philip, I says, what's your uncle do? You know, what do you guys do? You know, and he said, well, I'll show you. Took out a magazine, and it was the Philadelphia magazine. He pointed to it, and the title of the chapter in the magazine was Contract Killings, I believe it was. And in the article, in fact, it said that there was a judge murdered, okay, at a certain time, a Helfont, and two other people in this article, and they were indicted for it, and it never went to court. Nobody ever testified against them. So this is what we do. This is what we get away with, and whatever we say between us, we keep it between us. You don't repeat it to anyone, even my uncle or anybody.
Nicky Scarfo asked you if you had any guns,
mm-hmm.
and you had a hunting rifle and a .32 caliber Colt revolver.
Right.
He asked to borrow them, and you mm-hmm. gave them to him.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any sense of what he wanted them for?
Yes. Let me say this first. At this point in time, if you knew Nicky Scarfo, if you knew him, or even Philip Leonetti at the time.
His nephew.
If they asked you to do something, you better not refuse. Because I have three children. They know that. Okay? My wife. I got family there. The whole thing. And yes, I know people ask me that question all the time. Why did you give him the guns? Didn't you know who these people were? I had no choice with this guy. I knew if I did not do that, give him those guns, okay, I might have had a problem. He might have killed me.
Well, one of those guns, the Colt revolver, ended up being the murder weapon at the murder that you witnessed.
Right.
The person murdered was Vincent Falcone. Who was he?
He was a cement contractor.
And who are the people there?
Nicky Scarfo, Philip Leonetti, and Lawrence Merlino.
And how did you get to be there with them?
I was invited to a Christmas get-together party. That's where the murder happened. That's when Philip Leonetti shot Vincent Falcone to death.
And how did it happen? You witnessed it.
Nicky Scarfo was there. He told Vincent Falcone to start to make some drinks. He had his back turned. So Vincent starts to make some drinks, and Phillips Leonetti standing beside me. Nicky Scarpa sitting on the couch, and Vincent Falcone's got his back turned, okay, to myself and Philip Leonetti. So Philip Leonetti's about a half a step behind me, standing next to me, pulls out a gun in a flash, puts it up and back of this guy's head, Vincent Falcone, and pulls off a shot. As the guy's going down to the floor, Vincent Falcone, Philip looks at me, I mean face to face, and tells me he's got the gun by his side, which is my gun, tells me that this guy was a no good MF Joe, and he's staring at me. Then Nicky gets up off the couch, puts his arms on my arms, and says, you're one of us now. So Nikki goes up to the body of Vincent Falcone, which is there. The guy's staring. He's completely helpless. And he listens to his chest. Scarfo does. And Scarfo asks Philip for the gun. You know, he says, I think that we should give him another one. And Philip says, I'll do it. So he put the gun up against Vincent's chest and pulled off another shot.
Did you say anything or do anything? What could you do?
All I could do is act as though that it didn't bother me. Because if I showed any fear, Philip would have shot me dead, I could tell. That was my test for these people. They wanted to see. They didn't tell. They lied to me. They didn't tell me they were going to kill Vincent Falcone. They didn't do that. I was the only one in the room beside, the victim, okay, that I didn't know it was going to happen.
So you think they were testing you?
Sure.
For?
Grooming me, recruit me into their organization.
What led them to believe that you wanted to get in?
Well, I was living at their place. He was looking for new recruits. Scarfo has a way to, how could I say it? He's got a way to take an individual, okay, and put the fear of the devil in him, okay? And that's the way he is. And once he gets his hooks into you, you don't say no to Scarfo. You don't say no. You don't walk away. There's no way.
So once you've witnessed a murder, what are your choices?
Well, you don't have too many choices. You join these people, which I wasn't. That was out. There's no way I was going to. You can go to the law. Okay, you can tell the law. You could run, which I couldn't run. Very confusing at the time. So I took the road. I talked to the law and told them and testified for the state of New Jersey.
Let's take a break here,
mm-hmm.
and then we'll talk some more.
Right.
My guest is Joseph Salerno, and after witnessing a mafia murder in 1979, he turned government witness against organized crime in the Philadelphia, South Jersey area. He's now a member of the Witness Protection Program and has been since 1980. He's written a book about his life. It's called The Plumber. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Joseph Salerno is my guest, and that isn't the name he uses most of the time because he's in the Witness Protection Program. So you witnessed this murder and decided you didn't want to be part of the mafia. How did you get to the police? What did you do first?
Well, I went to my home in Brigantine, and I stayed in my house for 3 days. I wouldn't come out of my house. Of course, I told my wife about it. I mean, it was just... you know, just a shock kind of a thing. You don't know what to do. You think that you, it was your gun, you were there, you helped carry the body out. I'm guilty too. I'm a murderer too. This is what you think. But you know, you know you really didn't want to participate in that. Would anybody ever believe you? That type thing. I mean, it keeps bouncing back and forth. What are you going to do when you don't have an answer? So sure enough, a few days later, the Atlanta County Prosecutor's Office came to my house and told me that I would be next. They had an informant that told them that Joe Salerno's next to be hit out in the street by the Scarfo group. And I had said they didn't say anything about Vincent Falcone, nothing. You know, if I knew anything about that, they had no idea. They just picked this up out in the street. And so I told them I know all about the Falcone thing. I followed him down to the prosecutor's office with my own car. I stayed there 13, 14 hours. They taped me, the rights, all that business, the whole thing. And I agreed to be state witness against Scarfo, Philip Leonetti, and Lawrence Merlino in the Falcone murder.
You have testified against the Scarfo family several times. I wonder what it was like for you, those times when you walked into the courtroom and saw him, and these are the only times you had seen him since the murder.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first time was the Falcone case, which they were acquitted in that case, and I testified. You know, you got the information on that, but it's a terrible feeling, you know, to face that. But it's just something that you have to do. You know, you can't back up on it, you know, and you have to force yourself. The anticipation's worse than really being there.
Well, do you make eye contact, or do you try to not look him in the eye?
The first trial, I, in fact, got the prosecutor, Jeffrey Blitz, made me get up off the stand and walk up to them and point each one of them out, you know, for the jury. That's how we started the case. And it was difficult. I mean, it was a tough thing to do.
Did he have you walk up to them
mm-hmm.
to...
identify them.
But it seems like a very dramatic way of doing it. You could have just pointed to them.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he have you walk up to them like that?
Well, I think it was a good idea because to show them, and I guess the defense lawyers, this is my theory, I don't know, first time I was ever asked that, that we can intimidate them just as much as they intimidate us. You know, so that's how it went.
In 1982, your father was shot, and this was allegedly a hit against him in revenge for your having testified against mm-hmm. Scarfo. And he got shot through the neck, but he survived.
Yes.
Your family asked you to not testify again after mm-hmm. that happened.
Right.
Why do you think they asked you to do that? Out of fear for their own lives?
Sure,
or was there something else there?
Yeah, I promised I never would do it again, you know. My father was on his hospital bed, and he told me, he says, son, promise me you'll never do it again, you know. Don't ever testify against these people anymore. And I listened to him, and I wanted to keep my promise, and there came a time that a prosecutor in Camden, New Jersey, I won't mention his name, wanted me to testify in a case, Local 54 type thing, and I didn't know very much about it. Anything I heard about it was all hearsay type thing. I refused him. I said I didn't want to do it. So he didn't take that for an answer, and we were going back and forth. So he says, we'll force you to testify. So I says, no, you won't. I says, because you won't find me. So long story short, I had to start running from the marshals because they're the ones that got the word to go find me. So I was in a predicament that I was running away from the law and running away from Scarfo at the same time, that type of thing. It was a bad, bad situation. So got on the phone. I couldn't run anymore. Couldn't do it. Got on the phone with Joe Corey from the Atlanta County Prosecutor's Office. I was in touch with him all the time for the whole 10 years. I always took his word, the whole thing, and he convinced me to give myself up and don't run anymore because you can't. It's too hard to do, which it was difficult to do. It was really tough. So I did. We got on the phone with another marshal from Philadelphia, and he promised that everything would be fine. They'd pick me up, and just like the last other times I testified, they would treat me the same way. So we agreed with that. Told them where I was. Two marshals... Two cars with marshals in them came to the motel room where I was staying. I had the door open. They came in. They threw me up against the wall. They handcuffed me, shackled me, put me in the car, told me to keep my mouth shut, dumped my clothes all over the room, okay? Took me to jail, put me in jail in population. They took me from there. They arraigned me. And during the arraignment, they were calling my name out, my real name, and I was in population again in a jail cell with a bunch of criminals that were ready to be sentenced. So I didn't.
They might have known who you were.
Yeah, sure. There's a contract out on me. I mean, I'm scared now. I'm paranoid, you know, of everything. I finally got to the stand to testify. I wasn't on a stand for 10 minutes. The judge dismissed the case completely. So all that for nothing. I lost my truck. They repossessed my truck. I couldn't pay the payments on my truck. My tools were in the truck. I lost that. And, you know, I mean, I was out in the street.
So after you had decided that you didn't want to testify, and after you testified only under pressure from the authorities, what made you voluntarily decide to testify in 1988 in the trial against the Nicky Scarfo and his crime family?
Well, first of all, I had a vendetta against these people because they made me witness a murder, number one. Number two is they shot my father. And the only way I can get back at these people for what they did and ruin my life and my family is to take a chance on testifying in the 1988 RICO trial.
How did your life change when Scarfo and 15 members of his crime family were actually put behind bars? I mean, was there a change the next day in the amount of freedom that you felt, in the way you felt about yourself and the decisions you'd made?
Well, of course. I'll tell you, you know, I took a chance on testifying. I was not forced by the FBI. I did it willingly. And when I heard the verdict, I mean, I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was the best thing I heard in 10 years. And I'm sure there was a lot of other people that enjoyed it just as much as I have, because, I mean, it was a terrorist gang out there. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, are probably in peace today that the group's away.
Let me ask you a few questions about your life now, and I don't know how much you could tell us, so you can just tell us whatever's appropriate, you know, that's tellable. But you still have a plumbing business?
I have, you know, I have a little truck, tools, and I work myself. You know, I do a little advertisement, you know, no yellow pages, nothing like that, and that's how I make my living.
Does it get easier over time when you've had to establish a new identity, a new past for yourself? You know, once you've lived in that new identity for a few years, does it get easier?
No, it never gets easier, because you just learn to live with it. You make the best of it. It don't get easier. You know, I want my original name back. I want to be able to come and go as I please. You know, I like to, you know, visit my family Christmas, you know, and don't have the problem of looking behind my back all the time. You know, no, it stays the same, you know, but you got to learn to live with it, and you do.
Did you ever think about plastic surgery or anything that would change your appearance and make you unrecognizable?
Well, it would be too obvious. Even if they could change my face, let's say, okay, completely, I still have my voice. I still would, you know, have my same body style, whatever. I mean that would be, you know, that would be something that I wouldn't really consider changing my whole face. I mean, you know, that wouldn't do me any good. Because if I visited, and I would like to go to Juniper Street, that's where my family lives. And if I was there for a week, people would know who I am just by looking at my back, the way I walk. You know, no, I would never do that. Mm-mm.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been Joseph Salerno, and his new autobiography is titled The Plumber, and it's co-written with Steve Revelle. Salerno is now in the Federal Witness Protection Program. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be Judge Robert Satter. In his new book, Doing Justice, he discusses some of the decisions he's had to make that have meant life, death, or prison, or freedom to the defendants. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Babar the Elephant is one of the most popular and enduring characters in 20th century children's literature. Babar was created in the 1930s by Jean Dobrunov. Coming up, we meet Laurent Dobrunov, who's written and drawn all the Babar books since his father's death in 1937. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz on mezzo-soprano Conchita Supervia. She was a celebrity in the early part of the century. Now there's a new compact disc of her performances. And Mark Halliday has a poem about the tonette. You may know it as the flutophone, the cheap, shrill, plastic imitation of a recorder. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. An earthquake struck Southern California late this afternoon, shaking buildings in downtown Los Angeles and an area from Santa Barbara south to San Diego. There have been no immediate reports of injuries. A spokesman for the Los Angeles Police Department was reached a short time ago and says a check for damage is being made now.
Right now we're being told that there was an earthquake just northwest of Upland. Our officers are patrolling the city, checking to see if there's any major damage. We haven't received any radio calls or any calls for requests for service in regards to the earthquake. Our helicopters will make an aerial check of the city, and you know they'll check the tall buildings, they'll check the reservoirs along with the fire department. And so far it looks like even though it was felt everywhere, it didn't do too much damage.
Early reports indicate the quake that struck in Southern California was moderate. NPR's Ina Jaffe has this report.
Scientists have not made a final determination of the magnitude of the quake. Preliminary estimates range from 5.5 to 6.0 on the Richter scale. There have been no reports of major damage so far. The quake struck about 3:42 Pacific time and was felt as far south as San Diego and as far north as Santa Barbara as a rolling motion lasting 15 or 20 seconds. There's even a report of a high-rise building in Las Vegas feeling the sway. Geologists currently have not determined the epicenter of the tremor, but scientists believe it was centered about 30 miles northeast of L.A. in San Bernardino County. That would make it the second quake in that area today. About 12:45 Pacific time, there was a quake measuring 3.6 in that area. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
Alaska's Redoubt volcano has erupted again, this time sending an ash cloud toward Anchorage. Joe Gallagher with members station KBBI has this report.
Mount Redoubt erupted twice today. The first eruption was described as moderate by the Alaska Volcano Observatory, but a second eruption was stronger, with pilots reporting an ash plume at 37,000 feet. The ash cloud drifted north and passed directly over Anchorage, about 120 miles northeast of Redoubt. The eruption halted air traffic at Anchorage International Airport, and carriers are still waiting for the air to clear so they can resume flying. The Drift River Oil Terminal, just 20 miles from the volcano, was evacuated immediately after the eruption. An overflight indicated that the oil storage tanks are intact and have not been damaged by volcanic debris. For National Public Radio, I'm Joe Gallagher in Homer, Alaska.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 10 points to close at 2,627.25 on volume of some 185 million shares. Trading was active as advancing issues led declines by a margin of 9 to 5. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. A few weeks ago, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviewed an opera recording that had a selection on it by one of his favorite singers, the Spanish mezzo-soprano Conchita Supervia. Lloyd's found a new compact disc reissue devoted entirely to her.
I remember the first time I heard the voice of Conchita Supervia. A friend played me a Supervia recording, and it was one of the strangest things I'd ever heard. Her voice was remarkably high and light for a mezzo-soprano, with a vibrato so fast and fluttery it seemed almost comic. But once I got used to it, I fell in love with it. she could use it to do the most phenomenally expressive things. For one thing, long before Marilyn Horne, Supervia could sing the great coloratura roles written for mezzo-soprano, especially by Rossini. Her voice was so flexible, she could sing with ease the trills and roulades a heavier voice couldn't begin to negotiate. This same lightness and flexibility allowed her to be uniquely adept at comic roles. Of course, comedy isn't simply a matter of vocal technique. Supervia's comic timing is a phenomenon unto itself. And her phrasing, her ability to color individual words, is rivaled only by Callas. Supervia's fast vibrato projects two almost contradictory qualities, innocence and sexual urgency. That lascivious throb in her voice made her one of the great Carmens. This new Club 99 disc includes the Habanera and Seguidilla in Supervia's less familiar versions, sung in Italian.
Ma fatto la gran follia, se non si è in due l'amor non v'è, là per tenermi compagnia, un bel garzon sarà con me. Un bel garzon va dall'inferno, e io l'ho scacciato con tre dì, ma questo coro mai in eterno, e sceglier vuol chi lo ferì. Bravo, alcun di lor non mi fissò, libera sono ancor non amo, chi m'amerò, io l'amerò, chi vuole un cuore può comprare, l'ora suono perché tardar, a tempo non ho per aspettar, col nuovo amante io me ne andrò. Presto il bastion di Divina, la troverò nella spazia, a danzar io con la seguita dall'incante a danzare. Tra la 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 la.
Supervia was a dazzlingly glamorous woman with brilliant eyes and a cherubic round face. In a film called Evensong, she's the seductive villainess and the only person you can't take your eyes off of. But she also excelled in playing so-called trouser roles, that is, male characters, often mischievous boys, who were meant to be sung by women, like Octavian in Der Rosenkavalier, Hansel in Hansel and Gretel, and most wonderful of all, Cherubino, the oversexed adolescent in The Marriage of Figaro. Here's Conchita Supervia in the greatest performance I know of Cherubino's Non so più cosa son cosa faccio. Cherubino is overwhelmed by his sexual drives. He's on fire one minute, freezing the next. Every woman he sings, every woman changes his color and his pulse rate. He feels only one desire, a desire he finds impossible to explain. Listen to the subtle rhythmic pressure Supervia puts on the word desio, yet her uncanny dramatic conviction never betrays the elegance of the Mozartian style.
Non so più cosa son, cosa faccio, or di fuoco, or sono di ghiaccio, ogni donna cangiar di colore, ogni donna mi fa palpitar, ogni donna mi fa palpitar, ogni donna mi fa palpitar. Mi si turba, mi si altera il petto, io parlare mi sforzo d'amore, un desio che non posso spiegar, un desio che non posso spiegar. Non so più cosa son, cosa faccio, or di fuoco, or sono di ghiaccio, ogni donna cangiar di colore, ogni donna mi fa palpitar, ogni donna mi fa palpitar, ogni donna mi fa palpitar.
Supervia was a much-loved celebrity of her time. She was born in Barcelona in 1895 and made her opera debut in Buenos Aires before she was 15. She sang some of her most memorable performances at the Chicago Lyric Opera. She died in 1936 at the age of 40, after childbirth. This remarkable Club 99 album emphasizes roles we don't usually associate with Supervia, including arias and duets from Mignon, Faust, Samson and Delilah, Hansel and Gretel, Musetta's aria from La Bohème, and even Solveig's song from Peer Gynt. It shows her remarkable range and proves what one critic once said and more than one has echoed. She was incapable of dullness.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new CD of mezzo-soprano Conchita Supervia. It's on the Club 99 label. This is Fresh Air. In the great forest, a little elephant is born. His name is Babar. These are the opening words of one of the most successful and well-known series of children's books of this century. The books tell the story of Babar, the kindly elephant king, and the forest animals he rules over. And they follow Babar's adventures on his journeys into the city. Jean de Brunhoff, a French painter, created Babar in 1931 for his two sons. But most people don't realize that de Brunhoff died in 1937 after completing only six books. My guest Laurent de Brunhoff, one of Jean's sons, resurrected Babar in 1946. Since then, he's written and illustrated more than 30 Babar books, and Babar has gone on to star in a movie and in his own TV series on HBO. A recent book by Nicholas Fox Weber, The Art of Babar, traces the history of the celebrated books. Weber says the original idea for Babar came from a bedtime story Laurent's mother made up. I asked Laurent de Brunhoff if he remembered her telling the story.
I don't remember her telling the story to my brother and I. It's one of those memories, you know, that you don't remember yourself, but you have been talked about by your friends or your parents. And my father at that time was not already a writer of children's books. He was a painter. And when we told him about these stories that my mother had told us, we were so excited that he wanted to make a book for us about it. That's what he did. And that was the birth of Babar.
How old were you when you did the first Babar book yourself?
I was 20, 21. At that time, I was in Montparnasse in Paris. This is the area where most of the artists and painters and sculptors live. And I was studying painting myself. And in this book by Nicolas Fox Weber, you can see some of my painting of that time, which were abstract, with absolutely no resemblance to Babar.
Well, how did you go from abstract painting to doing these wonderful paintings of elephants?
Well, I didn't go from one to another. I was doing painting, which were abstract, and at the same time, I wanted to have this little elephant alive again. So I started to make a book, and it was two different aspects of my life. And actually, after 10 years like that, it was difficult for me to go on, and I had to make a choice. That's why I just gradually dropped painting.
I'd like for you to talk with us about how you draw Babar, how you do all the elephants, actually. I mean, for instance, well, this is something your father started, but their eyes are just little dots. Mm-hmm. And I think, although they're just little dots, there's something very expressive about that. It's hard to explain.
Well, this is, it's right. It is a little bit magical. And I must say that I enjoy it very much, to just with a few dots or a little line to give the expression of a face, of an elephant face.
Maurice Sendak the children's book writer and illustrator, wrote the introduction for an anthology of six Babar stories, three of them written by your father, three of them written by you. And in the introduction, he talked about his reaction to the first Babar story, in which Babar's mother is shot by a hunter, and the baby Babar is off on his own. Mm-hmm. And Sendek said that the ease and remarkable calm in which the Brunov blighted the life of his baby elephant numbed me. Tell me what your reaction was when Maurice Sendak told you that he was just very very upset, by the way, that Babar's mother was shot. And
in fact,
what did you tell him?
I was a little bit amused, because this is a reaction that I hear very often, of course. There is something awful to have the mother shot on the second page of a children's book. But and I would point out that this idea was my mother's, not my father. And this is the only death in the book, except that the old king is dying too in the same book. And that was my mother's idea again. I think Maurice, who is a good friend of mine, put too much, he emphasized too much the aspect of the death of the mother. I think it's simpler than that. The writer, and the person telling the story, wanted the hero, Babar, to be free, I mean, to struggle with the world all by himself, and to get himself in control of his own life. That's why the link with his mother was broken. And Babar, in fact, the characteristic of this character is that it is always in control of any situation.
So it becomes a story about growing up, about separating from your parents.
Exactly.
And finding your own self.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, I have to tell you about, you probably know about this, I'm sure you must, but there's another interpretation of the Babar stories that I want to ask you about. Ariel Dorfman, who's a Chilean writer, has a book called The Empire's Old Clothes, What the Lone Ranger, Babar, and Other Innocent Heroes Do to Our Minds. And it's an analysis of Walt Disney and Babar and the Lone Ranger and how they feed into certain kind of capitalist and colonialist fantasies. And he describes the Babar stories as an idealized colonial history. He writes, "History is sweetened up. The way in which Europe handled the natives in Africa is justified. Sure, there was some plundering in Africa, but just look at how happy the elephants are now." How do you react to that kind of analysis of the Babar stories?
Well, I know the theory of Ariel Dorfman, and I think there is a lot of truth in that theory. What irritates me is the lack of humor, the total lack of humor of Dorfman about that. I mean that it is true that we can find some kind of a colonialist cliché in the story of Babar, this little elephant coming from the jungle and meeting civilization and coming back, bringing civilization to his pal, of course. But that was the way people thought at that time. So it is not surprising that there is some kind of reflection of this philosophy in my first father book. But it's wrong to say that it's an imperialist book and this is giving bad ideas to kids, because the children don't read and look at books that way. They just enjoy them.
Do you feel that that there was a certain colonialism that you moved away from in your own books?
In my own book, I got another problem once. In I think it was my second book, I again was influenced by some stereotype of the 30s. I wanted to picture some black African people, And I did it in the way that they were presented by artists in the 30s, that is, with enormous red lips and things like that, and feathers, you know, as African natives, caricatured as they were in the 30s. And this book was published in France, and it was also published in America. And once an editor at Random House, who was not a children editor, but an editor of a novel, saw the book. She was black, and she was shocked. And guess who it was? It was Toni Morrison.
Oh, really?
And at that time, I was absolutely embarrassed, because I knew she was perfectly right, and was sort of ashamed of having a picture of the black in such a stereotype fashion. And we dropped this book.
So you mean the book's not in print anymore?
The book was not printed anymore.
Do you have any favorite children's books outside of the Babar books? Books that really made an impression on you when you were young?
Certainly Maurice Sendak. It's interesting because his mind and his way of drawing are so different from mine. But anyway, I like enormously his style and his mind. And
With Sendak, as you say, your styles are really different, because he does a lot of big, scary creatures, and his stories are often about the nightmarish things that happen to children.
Yeah, but maybe that's because I cannot do that. Sometimes I wish I could, but it doesn't come easily to my mind. So I respect him and I admire him for being able to do that.
Were you never haunted by nightmares and frightening thoughts?
Of course I was, but I cannot express that properly in my books. It's difficult for me to be frightening.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, it was a pleasure for me.
Laurent de Brunhoff writes and illustrates the Babar the Elephant books. He spoke to us from WPKT in Hartford, Connecticut. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. NPR's Tom Gelton has today's story from Managua, Nicaragua, on the planning for the future of the government to be run by the UNO coalition there after Sunday's election. An attorney for the National Wildlife Federation says he still has hopes that a federal grand jury will indict officers of the Exxon Corporation individually on criminal charges in connection with the Exxon oil spill. A report by Phyllis Crockett from the Soweto Township in South Africa and the future of the children there. And there's a new book, a biography of Nelson Mandela, which includes many of his letters from prison. We'll read from some of those letters, and we'll talk with the editor.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Poet Mark Halliday joins us again to read a poem.
When I was in elementary school, we had to play tiny little flutes that were called tonettes. This is a poem called Tonette. Said yes to Tish and Pat in Mrs. Cockman's fourth grade when they asked if I'd be in a tonette trio with them to play down in the valley and working on the railroad in front of the class. Though I must have known it was risky, I said yes because life was so rich and startling and involved with the frightening beauty of the smiles of girls, and to say no seemed a terrible shrinking from the challenge of the glory of life. I said yes to Tish and Pat, and they smiled. But I didn't practice at home. What did I imagine would happen? It seems I felt the beauty of the girls and the courage of my yes would be enough, and my reward for just being there and standing up in front of the whole class amid the deluge of life's stunning overstimulation would be a magical rightness of fingering when I gripped the stubby black tonette and blew. I did not practice at home. There was my arithmetic to do, and studying our geography chapter about llamas in Peru. There was important cowboy action on TV. Surely I must have rehearsed once with Tish and Pat. But if so, I joked my way through it, and I suspect they supported my notion that girls needed to practice Tonette, whereas a boy, who got A's in arithmetic and must someday inherit the world's beauty, would just naturally know every note to hit. But I didn't, oh Lord. All I could play was the first 6 or 8 notes of each song, and then confusion flooded me. I was terrifically lost in the gorgeous alien world. Tish and Pat played on, playing carefully to make up for the red-faced boy who stood beside them in front of the vast fourth-grade class and Mrs. Cockman, who saw everything. And I kept twisting the mouthpiece of my black Tonette all through the 100 hours of Tish and Pat playing every note of each enormous melody. I twisted that mouthpiece and made faces to indicate that if only my instrument were properly aligned, I could play Down in the Valley all day. Nobody believed that bit of theater for a second. Not for a second. When the epic performance ended, I went to my seat, grinning with ears like scarlet beacons. My grin tried to say, "Boys don't need music," but said instead, "I am lost on this planet." Mrs. Cockman let it pass and called on the next performers, and I sat, not quite knowing that I would never forget. Did I learn a lesson? Have I learned it yet? The beauty of Earth cannot merely be met. To stand up beside it, you've got to sweat. Yes is fine, but don't fake your Tonette.
Mark Halliday's collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. Tonette Solo by producer Naomi Person. Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet produced the Interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Down in the
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the daily work of a judge with Judge Robert Satter. Also, we meet short story writer Stephanie Vaughan, and Ken Tucker reviews the new album from J.J. Cale. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.